So Ruth chapter 4, we're reading the whole chapter. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there, just as the guardian redeemer he had mentioned came along. Boaz said, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, "Sit here," and they did so. Then he said to the guardian redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me, so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line." "I will redeem it," he said. Then Boaz said, "On the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property." At this, the guardian redeemer said, "Then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it." Now, in early times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it yourself," and he removed his sandal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, "Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today you are witnesses." Then the elders and all the people at the gate said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nashon. Nashon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz. Boaz the father of Obed. Obed the father of Jesse. And Jesse the father of David.
Search us, God, and know our hearts. Test us, and know our anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in us, and lead us in the way everlasting. We ask that in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, in the film When Harry Met Sally, the two main characters, Harry and Sally, surprisingly enough, are meeting for the first time on a road trip. And as they get talking, Harry tells Sally that he always reads the last page of a novel before he reads the rest of the book. "That, my friend, is a dark side," he tells her. Well, I don't know if you have a dark side and you like to read the last page of a novel first. Certainly my wife does. She always reads the last page before she bothers to read the rest of a book. Well, if so, perhaps you've been tempted to take a peek into Ruth chapter 4 and to see how this book ends, particularly if you've been with us over the past 3 weeks. I wonder, are we in for a Shakespearean tragedy with half the cast dead and our hopes dashed? Or is it going to be a Disney film ending with they all lived happily ever after? Well, things have certainly started out, haven't they, as a heart-rending story. There were tears for Naomi right from the off. In five short verses at the beginning of chapter one, the bottom just fell out of her world. And we stood next to Naomi as she tended the graves of her husband, but even worse, of her two sons. We looked, didn't we, on a broken woman. A woman who still believed in God, a woman who knew that the Lord was sovereign, but a woman who'd lost any sense of his goodness and his grace to her. And that's an incredibly hard place to be. And some of us this evening are right there. We're at a chapter in our lives when everything seems dark. We've lost loved ones, and the pain is with us every day. We grieve at the way that life has turned out, so many hopes dashed, so many frustrations. We know he's the Lord, but where is he when our world is falling apart? Well, in chapter 2, we got to see with Naomi where the Lord is when everything seems hopeless. We saw God work through the mercy of his providence, to see him working both in the big and the small of our story. We saw he also works through the grace of his people. It is through us ministering to one another that the Lord's covenant love is then poured out on his people. We are the channel of his blessing to one another. And even when the Lord seems to have abandoned us, when he doesn't respond to our prayers, when our desperate situations are not fixed, then we saw that he is still committed to us with that loving kindness, that hesed love, that love which no matter what we do or what we say or how we are, will carry on pursuing us and chasing us and winning us, a love that will not let us go. Well, last week, as we got to chapter 3, we saw that such confidence in God's control and in his compassion doesn't leave us with our arms folded, waiting for God to do everything. Even as Naomi and Ruth began to hope against hope that maybe God was working for their good, they didn't wait and just let it all unfold before them. We saw they both took big risks in chapter 3 to move forward the story that God was writing in their lives. And so we saw too that we are co-authors in our story, that God calls us to act, to make decisions, to take action, all the time with integrity and with purity. So this week then, as we come to the end of our series, as we come to Ruth 4, I want us to think again about how to make sense of our story, the story of our lives. Some of us tonight have a story that reads just like Naomi's. We have chapters of sorrow and seemingly meaningless suffering. But some of us would have to say, well, I've never known this kind of heartache. Not yet, anyway. But don't we all live with the question of what is the story of my life all about? Don't we from time to time ask just what is God up to? What is God doing? Don't we question the mundane and the frustrating and the tedious and the insignificance of it all? Do our lives mean anything? Are our stories worth something? Do our lives count? Do we matter? Those questions, I guess we all have at some level or another. And chapter 4 of Ruth begins to give us some answers to the significance of our stories. So I want us to walk through the chapter together and really tonight just pick up two threads. And the first thread is this: the significance of our sacrifices. The significance of our sacrifices. We left things, didn't we, in chapter 3 on something of a knife edge last week. Some of you are old enough to remember those black and white mini-movies that you would go and watch at the cinema on a Saturday morning. The hero, maybe Flash Gordon, was about to be crushed by a boulder or zapped by a laser beam, and it was just impossible for him to escape. He was definitely going to be crushed. He wasn't going to make it through to next Saturday morning. But you turn up again next Saturday, and somehow Flash would make it out okay. It seemed impossible, but Flash would find a way. And he always managed to do that. Flash was always left on a knife edge. And here was the knife edge in Ruth chapter 4. Boaz had promised Ruth that he would play the part of the guardian redeemer. He'd agreed to marry her, to protect her, to take care of her. But there was a whacking great fly in the ointment. There was another guardian redeemer who had a prior claim on Ruth. That was no good for the story, was it? This prior guardian redeemer. We want Boaz to be the one who marries Ruth. And so as we hit chapter 4, there's a bunch of questions that are floating around. Firstly, will Boaz actually marry Ruth in the end? Will Naomi's emptiness and brokenness ever be fixed? We've traced that story of her brokenness all the way through. And does it all end happily ever after? You see, Boaz is at the heart of the action in chapter 4. Naomi said that was what's going to happen back in verse 18 of chapter 3. She promised Ruth that Boaz would not rest until the matter was settled. And that's exactly what we find. Ruth and Naomi are having their morning coffee and Boaz is down at the town gate. No unnecessary delay, no waiting around. Boaz is going to get this sorted, verse 1. Now, the town gate may seem like a pretty strange place to go. I don't suppose we would turn up at the town gate if we were trying to sort out our fiancé. But the town gate was where business was conducted. This is a bit like heading off to the council offices. And it turns out to be a great place to go because, verse 1, no sooner has Boaz sat down than the other guardian redeemer turns up. The elders are all there as well. They can just get on with business. And verse 3, Boaz sets out what needs to happen. And we find out some new information. There's some land that needs sorting out as part of this whole guardian-redeemer deal. And Boaz talks it all through carefully, and he makes it pretty clear, I think, that he is more than willing to do this. He's going to redeem the land, and he's going to take Ruth to be his wife. That's great. This is the guy we want. We want this guardian-redeemer out of the way so Boaz and Ruth can just start writing their wedding invitations. And so verse 4, look at verse 4, it's a hammer blow to the story. Because this guy, who we don't even know his name, he says, I'll redeem it. Yes, says the guardian redeemer, this sounds like a great deal. I fancy this piece of land. This will add to my estate. Let's do it. Where do I sign? Lovely jubbly. Fantastic. What on earth's going on here? This isn't how it's supposed to turn out, is it? We don't want Ruth ending up having a wedding with this guardian redeemer. It looks like everything's gone pear-shaped again. And I wonder if that resonates with some of you tonight. Just when it seemed like you were picking up the pieces after a disaster, just when it looked as if life was back on an even keel, and something came along and kicked you in the teeth. Almost isn't that one of the toughest things to bear? We can take things, can't we? We can take things for a while and we take it again. And then it seems as if the Lord is at last leading us through, allowing us to come out the other side, and then we get this hammer blow. The cancer that we thought was in remission for so long, suddenly it returns. Our daughter, who has struggled with so many disappointments, and now she's got this really lovely best friend at school, and suddenly she hears that that friend is going to be moving to the other end of the country. A relationship that we had that has turned around and has started improving, and suddenly there's a big bust up and it's worse than ever before. We'd love life to be simple, wouldn't we? It's always complicated. It's always confusing. Often it doesn't make any sense. That's just the reality, isn't it? Imagine if Naomi and Ruth had a kind of video link through to this courtroom scene. Feel their heartache. This is the moment when they think it's going to be sorted out, when the love of Ruth's life is going to come back to her. This is not how it's supposed to be, this guardian redeemer. But friends, don't lose heart yet. Verse 5, Boaz isn't done. Boaz isn't done. Just as God isn't done yet with you and me. Verse 5, Boaz explains that Ruth the Moabite, well, she is part of the deal. There's a marriage that will need to take place. And I want you to see, most pertinent of all, is the reason for why all these things are wrapped up. Boaz says, this is so that the name of the dead might be maintained with his property. We'll come back to that in a second. But suddenly now, look, the guardian redeemer is not so keen. You've never seen anyone backtrack so fast as this guy. Twice in verse 6 he says, I cannot do this. I cannot do this. Did you hear me? I cannot do this. I'm not going to do this. And can you imagine the Israelites who are sat around their campfires telling this story to one another? Little Johnny or little Benjamin says, Kind of tell me, Dad, tell me the story of Boaz and Ruth. I'd love to hear that story again. Can you hear them at this point where the guardian redeemer says, I'm not going to do this? Can you hear them begin to cheer because now Boaz is free to marry Ruth? You guys can give a little cheer if you like yourself. If you're feeling daring, you can give a little cheer. But now look, the guardian redeemer, now he's washed his hands of this. Look, he's in a hurry to be off. We shake hands on a deal, don't we? The Israelites give away sandals. That's the way they did things. So the guardian redeemer, he slips off his sandal and he slips away. He's done. This is it. He's off the picture. And in verse 9 to 10, Boaz makes everything legally watertight. He accepts the responsibility for buying the property. He is going to marry Ruth. But notice, he will do exactly what the guardian redeemer hesitated to do. He will marry Ruth. Notice, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. I don't know if you noticed, but there's been an interesting theme of names that runs through the book. Remember that Naomi wanted to scrap her name altogether. Don't call me Naomi. Pleasant. Call me Mara. Bitter, she said back in chapter 1. Ruth has nearly always been called Ruth the Moabitess through the book, reminding us of her lowly status and her unpromising credentials. And you see, the real difference between Boaz and the other guardian redeemer is the willingness to give up the right to a name. The right to a name. You see, this property they were both in line to purchase would bear the name of Elimelech, not Boaz. And we need to know this was such a big deal. Because to have your name disappear, if Elimelech's name had disappeared, it was virtually to say you had never existed at all. It was the ultimate shame. It was the ultimate statement that your life didn't matter. But the other guardian redeemer, he is not willing to take this property unless it bears his own name. He's not willing to make that kind of sacrifice. He'd pay the money to get the field. The money wasn't the problem. But he wanted the field to come under his name, his estate. So when he says he cannot redeem it, he doesn't mean he cannot legally. He means he was unwilling to sacrifice. Boaz, on the other hand, Boaz was different. He was a man willing to sacrifice his own legacy, to sacrifice his future name because he loved Ruth. And isn't this something of a picture of true sacrificial love? Sacrificial love is a love that isn't in it for the credit. It's not in it for the credit. Most of us love for the credit, don't we? Yes, we might be willing to make apparent sacrifices. But often don't we do it in the hope that we'll receive love back from somebody else? Or that we'll earn a good name for the love that we show? Honestly, so often my love for others is driven by a desire to increase my reputation in other people's eyes. Not because I truly desire to sacrifice. And to sacrifice for someone is to bleed for them. Is to bleed for them, to become less, that they might become more. Friends, what would it look like if we had a community here where we bled for one another? Where we bled for one another. Not just did nice things for one another. Not just helped one another out, but really bled for each other. When we gave up any sense of our own reputation. Stop thinking about how good things made me look. What would that look like? Wouldn't that be a frighteningly authentic community? What a place that would be. Something that would make the world stop and stare. Something transformational. But I want you to see something quite beautiful here too in verse 11 and 12. Look at the blessing that Boaz receives from the elders and the people. The elders and all the people at the gate said, "We are witnesses," just as Boaz had requested. "May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offering the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." This is a bit of a strange speech, isn't it? We don't really seem to need all this. Let's just get on with the wedding. We're ready now. And yet, hold on a second. Just have a look at these words. Notice the focus again on name. On name. Verse 11, Boaz, may you have standing in Ephrathah. May you be famous in Bethlehem. In other words, may your name, the name that you are willing to give up, may that be honoured and celebrated. And may your wife's name, may Ruth, may she be honoured like the great matriarchs of the past, Rachel and Leah, who gave birth to the 12 tribes of Israel. Verse 11, and may your sons and daughters, may that family be like the line of Judah, another line that began between the union of a foreign woman and produced Perez. Boaz, may the very thing that you are willing to give up, may that be given back to you, a great name. And don't we see that happen even in this very book? Whose name do we know tonight? Whose name do we know? We know Boaz, the one who was willing to give up his name, not the guardian redeemer who just wanted to protect his name. In fact, when Boaz calls him friend, back at the start of the chapter, the Hebrew equivalent is something like Mr. So-and-so or Joe Bloggs. You see, his name just vanished into the ether. But Boaz, we're all celebrating his name tonight. He was willing to give up his name, and so he retained it. And friends, here's the exciting, the beautiful truth of the gospel. It's as we give ourselves away, it's as we die to self, that then we truly find life. It's as we lose our life that we will find it. You see, God longs for greatness for us. He really does. He longs for greatness. He longs for us to have a great story. But it's not the fickle. It's not the temporary. It's not the fairy lights kind of greatness of the world. Rico Tice, the evangelist, tells of going to speak in a school where they had two boards up on the wall. The two boards celebrate Nobel Prize winners and Olympic gold medalists. That was the measure of success at that school. But in the kingdom of heaven, there's a different honour board. It's not full of Olympians. It's not full of Nobel Prize winners. It's a board that records our tiny acts of love and self-sacrifice. Do you remember the parable of the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25? When the Son of Man comes in his glory, what does he commend his people for? You won a fantastic gold medal at the Olympics. You won a Nobel Peace Prize. Does he commend his people for those things? No, this is the honour roll that Jesus puts up. I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. When we go visiting in the old folks' homes, when we make a meal for someone in need, when we give away second-hand clothes, when we give hospitality to somebody new in Nottingham, those tiny, apparently insignificant moments, they are the moments in your story that God treasures, that the Lord treasures up and will honour us for. They go on his honour roll. They go on his board. Nothing is lost. Nothing is unnoticed. And one day he will commend us for it. We will have a name that endures forever. Well, the significance of our sacrifices. Alec, can we have the next slide? The second thread of this chapter is the significance of our sufferings. The significance of our sufferings. Finally, we get to the end of the story. The wedding day is here at last. Naomi is there sipping her sweet sherry at the wedding day. She has a look of contentment all over her face. She agrees with all those who come by and comment that, don't Boaz and Ruth, don't they make a lovely couple? And then one day, not long after, Naomi gets a call from Ruth. Naomi, I've got some news. Are you free next Wednesday to come to the hospital? I'm booked in for an ultrasound. You're going to be a granny. You're going to be a granny. Not many months later, Naomi gets a text from Boaz that Ruth has been taken into labour. And soon after that, Ruth is on the phone asking, would you like to come and meet your new grandson? You know what news of a new baby is like, don't you? That news spreads like wildfire around the town. Everyone's asking about the weight, the name. Who does he look like, Ruth or Boaz? But then the women of the town turn their thought to Naomi, the woman who come back to Bethlehem with the name Bitter, the woman who come back empty. What a turnaround. What a turnaround for Naomi. What do the women say? Verse 14, praise be to the Lord who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. The guardian redeemer they refer to here is not Boaz. This is the young child, Obed. Naomi, you see, remember, she had all her security stripped away. That loss of her husband, that loss of those sons, that was her welfare. That was her safety net. That was all gone. But this child now will continue the family line. This is the security that has been returned to her after death had stripped it away. And in verse 16 and 17, we get a beautiful picture of Naomi's restoration. The woman who had once wept at the loss of her sons now cradles a son in her arms. And when the women of the town come and say, Naomi has a son, she doesn't correct them as she did back in chapter 1. She doesn't say, no, I'm not Naomi. Call me Mara, call me Bitter. She takes the name. She takes the name because now she knows what it is to feel her true name, Naomi, pleasant. After all the sorrow, after all the tears, here at last is rejoicing. And God's redemptive work in our stories will always end in rejoicing and restoration. Always. The end of Naomi's story is a mirror for us of what will eventually happen with each of us, with each of God's people. But don't misread this. Don't misread this. Did all of Naomi's heartbreak of the past vanish with the birth of this child? Did every scar of the past suddenly disappear? No, I don't think that's the point. I mentioned a few weeks ago that some years ago I went to the funeral of a dear friend of mine here in Nottingham who died in his early 30s. Tragically, he left behind his wife and two young boys. But in the grace of God, she has remarried a lovely man who's adopted the two boys and they have another son together. And her life has been put back together. But she still misses her first husband. She still bears the pain of that loss and the scars of that loss. And the Christian response to loss and pain is not to somehow say, well, it'll turn out all right in the end, so chin up and stop worrying. That is not the point of the story. God doesn't promise to fix all of our problems in this life. He doesn't. Does he promise to all those who've suffered heartache that they will eventually stop hurting? Does he promise to the broken family that he'll fix things now? Does he promise to the childless couple that the baby will eventually arrive? Does he promise to the Naomis in this room that in this life they will again be able to rejoice after the tears? I don't think he makes that promise. We all know, don't we, of situations and hurts that don't get mended. The promise of the gospel is not for every tear to be dried up now. So what then? What is the promise? The point of Naomi's story is that even out of the deepest pain and suffering, that God can bring something beautiful and redemptive. God will restore when all seems lost. For the story of Naomi doesn't end with Naomi, does it? It doesn't just end with her. When Naomi went to Moab, when she attended all those funerals, she never realised that the girl who was sat weeping next to her, Ruth, was going to follow her all the way back to Bethlehem. That Ruth was going to sacrifice her own prospects in order to protect and provide for Naomi. That this girl was not going to marry the rich or the young, but was going to marry Boaz, the guardian redeemer, so that Naomi's family could be maintained. That Ruth, as the women put it in verse 15, that she would prove to be better even than seven sons, the perfect family in Israelite eyes. That even in her time of suffering, Naomi found someone who was committed to her unconditionally. Someone who the women say loved her. They loved her. And it's in the deepest places of our suffering that we may experience the deepest places of grace and love. It is in the darkest times that sometimes we get to taste loving kindness that we would never know otherwise. I don't know why some chapters have been written in your story. I don't know why the Lord decided that your childhood should be so tough. Or why teenage years should bring such conflict. Or why adult life has been such a struggle. Or why middle age has brought so much disappointment. Or why older age has brought so many fears. But through the dark night of the soul, have you heard the sound of his love in ways that you never thought possible? Has the Lord sometimes come to you, even in those places, and revealed the depth of his grace more tenderly and more sweetly than you ever knew before? Has another Christian radiated Christ in ways that made the gospel more real in those moments of deepest sorrow? But there's more. There's more here. Because the story of Naomi doesn't just end with Ruth or even Obed. It ends also with David, verse 17. The prayer of the elders in verse 11 gets its answer. Because little Obed, the gurgling baby on Naomi's knee, was the grandfather of David, the most famous king of Israel. David, the king who came to exemplify what it should be like for God's people to live under God's rule and blessing. David, the king, the man after God's own heart. Remember back in chapter 1, this story, when was it set? It was set in the days of the judges, the days of chaos. But it ends with the prospect, the line to the king who would bring stability and security and a return to God's ways. We thought we were just reading Naomi's story. And now suddenly in verse 17, we realize her story is part of something so much bigger. And friends, that is the amazing reality about our individual stories of redemption. Because all of our stories, they're all part of God's grand redemptive plan to restore everything under the headship of Christ. You see, the full value of our stories is not seen even in the moment we die. Even in the moment we die. Naomi doesn't have a clue about the full value of her story. She has no idea as she feeds Obed mashed up carrots sat on her knee that one day he will go on to be the grandfather of David. David, the great king of Israel. But the stories of our lives, they are connected to something big, to something grand, to something amazing, to something eternal that will last. And our lives, our mundane, tiny, insignificant, seemingly meaningless lives, they may not merit a best-selling biography in the world's eye. But in God's grand redemptive plan, they are the stories that will be told forever and forever. The story of redemption that God has worked in you. But friends, there's even more. Because the story of Naomi doesn't just end with Ruth or Obed or even David. It ends with Jesus. In verse 18 to 22, we get the family tree of David. It's a family tree that doesn't just pop up here in Scripture. It pops up again in Matthew chapter 1. The same names. Boaz, Obed, Jesse, David, and then Jesus. Jesus. Naomi never knew that it wasn't only Elimelech who took her to Moab, but it was the Lord who took her there because he wanted Ruth with her pagan past to be in the bloodline of Jesus' son. Naomi's suffering was working something far, far greater than she could ever dare have dreamed. And surely it's in Jesus himself that we see the most dramatic evidence that out of the deepest pain and suffering, God can bring something beautiful and redemptive. The suffering of Jesus at the cross, which seems irredeemable, that was the very moment when God worked redemption. What looked like a tragedy, the spotless Son of God hanging from a tree was actually God's greatest triumph. That the moment when all seemed lost, when hope was gone, when the Son of God loses his life, that is the very moment when he rescues his people. So that the cross that looked so dark and so evil was instead where God worked the very greatest good. And if God can turn the sufferings of Naomi into something good, and if he can turn the sufferings of Jesus Christ into something astonishing and fantastic, can't he bring something significant and wonderful even from our sufferings? That the very things that have appeared to us to be so empty and so hurtful and so devastating, that God has written each of them into our story for a far greater good. A much deeper good. And one day we will see that all things have worked together for good. One day that will be clear. One day we will sit with him and we won't just say, Lord, I learnt so much about your love in my sorrows. Nor will we just say, Lord, I learnt I was part of something so much bigger. One day we will sit. No, we will stand. We will stand. And we'll praise God for every hurt we ever endured. And we will rejoice that God knew exactly what he was doing. And that having seen the final story, we would not alter one line, not one word of the story that he wrote with our lives here on earth. And even then the story of our lives will not be over. It will not be over. In fact, it will just be beginning. And let me end with this. At the end of his book, The Last Battle, C.S. Lewis writes, picturing the new creation, picturing the world that is yet to come. And he writes these beautiful words. The things that began to happen were so great and so beautiful that I cannot write them. And for us, this is the end of all the stories, and we can most truly say they all lived happily ever after. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story. All their life and all their adventures in this world had just been the cover and the title page. Now at last they were beginning chapter one of the great story which no one on earth has ever read, which goes on forever and in which every chapter is better than the one before. And that is what awaits us, friends. So far, those pains and those agonies and those sufferings and the places where we've seen God's redemption, those things that give us the greatest joy and the things that cause us to shed the most tears, those things so far are just the cover page, they're just the title page. But then it will be the story that goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before. And friends, then we truly shall live happily ever after.